Welcome to the 67th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series, entitled Positive Barbarism, Brutal Aesthetics in the Post-War Period, art historian Hal Foster explores the pervasive turn from the mid-1940s to the early 1960s to the bru and the brutalist, the animal and the creaturely, as these are manifest in the early work of Jean Dubuffet, Georges Bataille, Asger Jorn, Eduardo Paolozzi, and Klaus Oldenburg. In this first lecture, entitled Walter Benjamin and His Barbarians, delivered at the National Gallery of Art on April 8, 2018, Foster probes how modernist art teaches us to survive civilization if need be.
I'm truly honored to deliver the Mellon Lectures, and let me say before anyone else does, I'm not worthy. This makes me all the more grateful to Elizabeth Cropper for her kind invitation, and really to everyone at CASVA for their warm welcome. And thank you all for coming too. As a habitual lecture goer, I often feel it's the audience that should be paid, not the speaker. So I'll offer a special prize to anyone who attends all six talks. My wife just informed me that she's dropped out. These lectures are born of my puzzling over a paradoxical statement by the German critic Walter Benjamin. Modernism teaches us how to survive civilization if need be. Although he varies the phrase in a few texts of the early 1930s, he never explains it. Apparently, it remained a riddle for him too. Given the situation in Europe, the referent of civilization is clear enough. It is the travesty of civilization authored by fascism and Nazism, civilization turned into its opposite. It is this barbarism, unleashed by the dictators that rose in the ruinous wake of World War I, that Benjamin hopes, in a desperate dialectic, to revalue. Barbarism, yes indeed. We say this in order to introduce a new, positive concept of barbarism. For what does poverty of experience do for the barbarian? It forces him to start from scratch, to make a new start, to make a little go a long way, to begin with a little, and build up further, looking neither left nor right. Among the great creative spirits, there have always been the inexorable ones who begin by clearing a tabula rasa. Yet what kind of modernism teaches us to survive a civilization turned barbaric? And what sort of survival could this be? Benjamin posed the notion of positive barbarism in a short text titled Experience and Poverty, written in summer 1933 when he was in exile, mostly in Paris, but for the moment in Ibiza. Hitler had come to power in January. It was the depth of the Depression, and Benjamin was as poor as the Spanish island was then. Hence his title, which I read as a chiasmus, both the experience of poverty and the poverty of experience. Certainly the essay abounds in dialectical twists of this sort, especially regarding the question of value, economic and other. In fact, the entire text is a parable that we are asked to tease out. Benjamin begins with an actual fable about gold. On his deathbed, an old man tells his sons of a treasure buried in their vineyard. They go out and dig for it everywhere, but find nothing. And yet, with the soil thus turned, the vineyard soon bears a great harvest of grapes. And thus they learn the blessing lies in hard work and not in gold. This is experience that produces wisdom, Erfahrung in German, as distinct from experience that supplies information, Erlebnis. And it can be passed on in tales like this one. Etymologically, tradition means to pass on. However, according to Benjamin, such experience, such passing on, is now impoverished. Who still meets people who really know how to tell a story, he asks. This old kind of knowledge is collective, a good thing for Benjamin, but he fails to acknowledge that it is also conservative and patriarchal. Moreover, as is often the case in critical theory, Benjamin projects a legendary past when subjectivity and society were intact in order to cast modernity as a breakup. And here he keys this fall to the trauma of World War I. Many people return from the front in silence, he writes, not richer, but poorer in communicable experience. For Benjamin, the wise speech of the old father had become the stunned muteness of the young soldier. A generation had gone to school in horse-drawn streetcars, now stood in the open air, runs a famous line from the essay. And at its center, in a force field of destructive torrents and explosions, the tiny, fragile human body. Benjamin describes this fall in a litany of reversals. Moral experience is undermined by corruption. Economic experience undercut by inflation. Physical experience undone by hunger. And yet in a major turn, the major turn in this text, he then embraces this poverty and so bids farewell to the very tradition of experience that he had lamented only a moment ago. It is this transvaluation, Nietzsche is on his mind as well as Marx, that enables Benjamin to advocate for modernist artists, writers, and architects who are able to start from scratch. His list of such constructors is unexpected. He mentions artists such as the Cubists and Paul Klee, writers such as Bertolt Brecht and Paul Schierbart, and architects such as Adolf Loos and Le Corbusier, odd couples all. Even though Benjamin knew of the Russian constructivists from his visit to Moscow in winter 1926-27, he does not invoke exemplary constructors like Alexander Rodchenko and Elazitsky. Clearly, his concern is the situation in Western Europe, one that was shipwrecked, not post-revolutionary. Apart from impoverished experience, what unites his different constructors? For one thing, they all reject the traditional, solemn, noble image of man. For Benjamin, this image enfolds a bourgeois subjectivity, a deep psychology, which they discard as outmoded. For example, Klee designs his figures schematically, as though on a drawing board. They have no inwardness, Benjamin comments, and that is what makes them barbaric. At stake here, then, is not a new order to be engineered so much as a bare condition to be endured. And the new man of utopian modernists like the constructivists, that's not so much the stake as the naked man of the contemporary world who lies screaming like a newborn babe in the dirty diapers of the present. That's a line from the essay, and it's an extraordinary line. Benjamin does sneak in one constructivist note, however. His constructors reject human likeness as a principle of humanism, and instead stress the arbitrary constructed nature of representation, as revolutionary Russians did, he notes, when they gave their kids dehumanized names like October. Still a great name for a kid, by the way. Rather than a technical renovation of language, Benjamin argues, this is its mobilization in the service of struggle or work, at any rate, of changing reality instead of describing it. And he means the echo of Marx here, to be clear. For Benjamin, modern architecture is most forthright in its rejection of interiority as inwardness. Although he acknowledges the utopian dimension of glass architecture, as advanced by Schierbart, Bruno Taut, and others, here the material signifies transparency, which he pits against the opacity of the bourgeois interior stuffed with private mementos. Objects made of glass have no aura, Benjamin avers. Glass is, in general, the enemy of secrets. It is also the enemy of possession. In short, modern architects like Walter Gropius create rooms in which it is hard to leave traces. And yet not everything is coldly objective in his account. In fact, at this point, Benjamin offers a wildly dialectical appraisal of technology. Even as it has produced a force field of destructive torrents, it has also released a fantastic array of creative possibilities. A bit like the 19th century caricaturist Granville, another Benjamin favorite, fantastical writers like Schierbart explore how our telescopes, our airplanes, our rockets can transform human beings into completely new, lovable, and interesting creatures. This transformative imagination is also at work for Benjamin in mass culture, especially in early Disney films. The existence of Mickey Mouse, he writes, is such a dream for contemporary man. His life is full of miracles, miracles that not only surpass the wonders of technology, but also make fun of them. In his account, Mickey cartoons are so popular because they offer tremendous relief to Europeans buffeted by catastrophic war, intensive industrialization, and economic depression. Magically, in these animations, a car is no heavier than a straw hat, and the fruit on the tree becomes round as quickly as a hot air balloon. It is thus not only modernist artists like Klee that teach us how to survive, so too do cartoon characters like Mickey. Yet in a prior fragment on Mickey, Benjamin makes a darker point about such metamorphosis. Mickey Mouse proves that a creature can still survive even when it has thrown off all resemblance to a human being. And further, here we see for the first time that it is possible to have one's arm, even one's body stolen, and still endure. Then Benjamin delivers his initial version of his key line. In these films, mankind makes preparations to survive civilization. There's far more to say about this extraordinary reflection on positive barbarism, but this is enough for me to present my own thesis for these lectures, which is simply this. Like everyone else, Benjamin thought that the worst had come with World War I, with a tiny, fragile human body caught in a force field of destructive torrents. But the worst had not come. It did not arrive until the mass deaths of World War II, the Holocaust, and the bomb. Only then did the positive barbarism that Benjamin glimpsed in modernist art, architecture, and literature become a necessity. Only then were artists and writers truly forced to start from scratch, to make a new start, to make a little go a long way. Yet in these extreme circumstances, what means could they hope to find? What ground could they claim with any conviction? What but the most basic and the most brutal? In these talks, I'm concerned, let's go back to these guys, with the turn from the mid-1940s through the mid-1960s to the brute and the brutalist, the animal and the creaturely, as manifest in the work of the Frenchman Jean Dubuffet and Georges Bataille, the Dane Asger Jorn, the Italian Scot Eduardo Poluzzi, and the Swedish-American Klaus Oldenburg. And there you see them, top to bottom, left to right, Benjamin, Dubuffet, Bataille, Jorn, Poluzzi, Oldenburg. Each of these figures proposes a different version of brutal aesthetics, one that pares art down or reveals it to be already bare, so that they might begin again after the compound devastations of the time. But to what ends exactly? Why does Dubuffet invent the category of art brut? What does Bataille seek in the cave paintings at Lascaux? Why does Jorn populate his Cobra campuses with denatured figures? What does Polozzi see in his monstrous assemblages of industrial debris? And why does Oldenburg remake cheap products from urban scrap? To begin again is an oxymoron, and the contradictions show in these projects. My figures aim for a foundational approach, only to find an equivocal one. They claim a clean slate, only to discover an overwritten one. Like Robinson Crusoe, whom Dubuffet and Oldenburg adopt as a persona, each washes up on an island of his own devising, only to find that it is less safe terrain than treacherous ground. There they confront tricky questions, and so will we. How could Dubuffet imagine an art that is unscathed by culture? What did Bataille hope to unlock in the enigma of prehistoric representations of animal and man? Why did Jorn picture the crises of his time in the form of human beasts? How did Polozzi pick out a path to survival in the destruction all around him? And why did Oldenburg stake his desire for metamorphosis in junk? My group includes two philosophers, Benjamin and Bataille, two painters, Dubuffet and Jorn, and two sculptors, Polozzi and Oldenburg. Yet they range over these disciplines in ways that transform them significantly. All the artists are also innovative writers. One object of positive barbarism is language, which they treat as both a tool and a target. Their texts are full of mangled words, invented terms, and other linguistic barbarisms. And some venture into philosophy or suggest that art can qualify as such. Many of my figures are connected personally as well. If we take Dubuffet alone, he was acquainted with Bataille, whom he read, and friendly with Jorn, about whom he wrote. Jorn returned the favor. And he influenced Polozzi, who studied his Art Brut collection in Paris, as well as Oldenburg, who did the same in Chicago. Dubuffet was a role model for both artists. Yet more important is this commonality. Each figure proposes a different ground for brutal aesthetics. In the first instance, this ground is a positing of a beyond or a before to official culture. Thus, for Dubuffet, Art Brut falls outside the history of art, while for Bataille, cave painting precedes it. Both thus claim a zero degree of art, one free of basic conventions of making and viewing. For them, Art Brut and cave painting even undercut the primordial convention that art is made to be beheld. However, what appears as an beginning can quickly become a mise en abyme. Perhaps this goes with the territory. Most of my figures are riddled by questions of origin. The origin of art and representation, of humanity and sexuality, of law and sovereignty, that are contradictory or at least enigmatic in nature. And sometimes, in the face of these riddles, they propose extreme notions, such as the brute in Dubuffet or the transgressive in Bataille, that qualify as limit concepts, that is, as ideas that point to a place where thought cannot go, for reasons ideological or historical or both. Sometimes, too, these limit concepts deliver them into double binds. Dubuffet projects various others, such as the child and the insane, as alien to culture, only then to acculturate them. And Bataille thrills to transgression, only then to acknowledge that it serves to reinscribe the law. Often, to borrow a Bataillean term, these projects are impossible. And they touch on a contemporary problem, as you will see, the problem of cultural appropriation. In the second instance, which is the first in order of practice, my artists seek a ground in brute materiality. For example, Dubuffet mixes in dirt, pebbles, and asphalt in his haute pâte paintings, while Oldenburg stuffs muslin and vinyl with kapok in his soft sculptures. In doing so, Dubuffet erodes the basic distinction of figure and field in painting, while Oldenburg counters the fundamental expectation that sculpture be vertical and stable. Often this partial undoing of the object induces, or is meant to induce, a partial undoing of the subject, both viewer and artist. And sometimes this operation is cast in terms of regression. Thus was Dubuffet greeted as a cacaist. Thus did Oldenburg describe his early sculpture as shit art. And thus, to often offer a third instance, did Polozzi see his object making as a mud language. Yet this regression is not necessarily a reduction. According to Freud, the infant does not distinguish much between a turd, a penis, a baby, and a gift. That is, in psychoanalysis, the anal zone is an open site of symbolic transformation, and so it is often in brutal aesthetics as well. This is to suggest that sheer materiality and semiotic metamorphosis are not opposed in this art. In fact, just the opposite obtains. Dubuffet, Jorn, Polozzi, and Oldenburg all show us how a substance can motivate a sign and how a sign can transform a substance. Thus do my artists experiment with language too. Some, like Dubuffet, brutalize it. Others, like Oldenburg, eroticize it, all play with it. Yet they find no secure ground here either. In every instance, they render language more ambiguous, not less. Sometimes this linguistic entanglement prompts a strong counterimpulse to sweep language away, or at least to clear art of names. If Duchamp proposed that a work of art can consist in nomination alone, a urinal becomes a fountain because the artist declares it so. Dubuffet and Oldenburg work to ex-nominate art. Art brute, Dubuffet insists, is art that does not know its name. In fact, they can be seen as anti-Duchamps, who militate for an aesthetic that is more motivated, not more arbitrary. Certainly my group as a whole counts as a neo-avant-garde distinct from the dominant Duchampian lineages. Language is one stake of positive barbarism then. Originally, a barbarian was a person who could not speak, at least in a way that a Greek could understand. The word evokes the stammering onomatopoeically, ba ba. And most of my artists would embrace the association, which is also active in brute, from the Latin brutus, dull or stupid. Bataille self-identifies as an anti-classical iconoclast, Jorn as a Nordic vandal, and the others as urban primitives. So how do they differ from the barbarians picked out by Benjamin two decades before? To be sure, some attributes of his positive barbarism carry over to my figures. They too are opposed to interiority understood as inwardness. And they also reject human likeness as a principle of humanism. Other characteristics in the Benjamin account simply do not last or are transformed utterly. For example, the fantastical merging of nature and technology glimpsed by Benjamin and Schirbart becomes monstrous in Polozzi, while the presence of the creaturely is even more pronounced, but as an avatar of damaged life, a la Theodor Adorno, not of playful adaptation, a la Mickey Mouse. Finally, my figures are more scavengers than constructors. But then that is true of some of the Benjamin barbarians as well. They too begin with a little and make it go a long way. I would be remiss not to mention two renowned uses of the term barbarism in the critical field that concerns us, especially as both should be differentiated from positive barbarism. The first use also comes from Benjamin, who in Theses on the Philosophy of History of 1940 his final essay before his suicide, wrote famously, "There is no document of civilization which is not, at the same time, a document of barbarism." This resonant formula is fundamental Marx. The luxury of culture depends on the expropriation of labor. Great art rests on oppressive inequality. Benjamin expresses this truth, pertinent to all times and places, not to spite what we love, but to remind us of its cost. And I imagine that all of my figures would agree with him. Even though I am the beneficiary a few times over of the Mellon family, I too agree. The second use of barbarism, also familiar, comes from Adorno in Cultural Criticism and Society of 1949. And it is equally chastening. To write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. Here again, my figures would agree, but they would also take this aphorism as a mandate to continue to make poetry, painting, and sculpture, only to make them more barbaric. And this is how Adorno came to understand his statement too. For him, a mimesis of the hardened was a central aspect of modernist art. Let me anticipate a few questions that will arise along the way. First, what relation do my artists have to the figurative tradition? Of course, pre-war modernists, Fauves, Expressionists, Cubists, Constructivists, Dadaists, Surrealists, they all distorted the figure in diverse ways. In doing so, however, they retained it as a foil. For the most part, this connection in opposition to the figurative tradition was swept aside by the Holocaust and the bomb, which obliterated the tiny, fragile human body en masse. Yet for my group, abstraction was not an option either, compromised as it was by pre-war associations with spirituality, utopianism, and idealism. For these reasons, my artists stick with figuration, but they remake it as disfiguration, an art of denatured bodies and stunted gestures. Such disfiguration is central to the brute in Dubuffet, the en forme in Bataille, the creaturely in Jorn, who titled a series of works Disfigurations, the monstrous in Polozzi, and the scatological in Oldenburg. Extreme though it is, this disfiguration could still be presented as a realism, as Oldenburg did with his first major project, The Street, a realism true to a society in which the capitalist processes of reification and fragmentation had moved out of the factory into the world. Importantly, most of my artists look for artistic materials in this second nature of industrial glut and commercial waste. Car wrecking yards as hunting grounds, Polozzi said of one of his sources. Junkyard is beach, is street, Oldenburg said of three of his sites. Some of my figures go so far as to see representation as an act of violence. Art proceeds by successive destructions, Bataille argued, with graffiti in mind. Insofar as it liberates libidinal instincts, these instincts are sadistic. Dubuffet would agree, and so would Jorn, if we replace sadistic with erotic. And even the benevolent Oldenburg took the phrase annihilate, illuminate as a central motto. The original inspiration of the store, he once remarked, was a butcher shop. Also paradoxically, my figures conceive mimesis as more performative than representational. Bataille longed for a return to the ritualistic basis of art that he detected in the caves. And Dubuffet insisted on presence and participation in his work. The painting will not be looked at passively, he insisted, but relived in its elaboration, dare I say, reenacted. In line with the contemporary phenomenology of Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Dubuffet moved to bracket pictorial conventions in an attempt to freshen perceptual capabilities and most of the others did too. Certainly, they all stressed process. In a way, they constitute a process art well before process art emerged as such, all with the ambition to reanimate subject-object relations, or at least to resist a society more and more dominated by the commodification of things and the administration of people. The second question, how do my artists relate to given models of avant-garde and modernist practice? Stylistically, they are closest to expressionism and surrealism, but for the most part, they regard both as exhausted. And to some degree, they shift from the subversive impulses of such movements toward the foundational imperatives of most modernist painting. At the same time, they have little interest in the formalist concerns with medium specificity. On the contrary, they might be said to advance a program of medium impurity. Of course, some preoccupations of brutal aesthetics do run back to pre-war precedents. Above all, the fascination with the primitive, whether this is associated with the art of the tribal, the child, or the insane, all of which the Nazis had declared degenerate only a decade or so before. Yet the primitives taken up by my group are not quite the modernist ones. After the intervention of Claude Lévi-Strauss and others, the savage mind could no longer be simply opposed to modern sophistication, which also meant that it could no longer be easily projected as pristine. So too, my figures complicate the modernist primitives with related avatars, such as the destitute outsider, whom Dubuffet calls the common man, and Oldenburg, the rag man. That's Oldenburg in a performance connected to the street. At issue in brutal aesthetics is less primitive life than bare life, less life unscathed by culture a la Dubuffet than life at the mercy of power a la Giorgio Agamben. The Benjaminian trope of the naked man in the dirty diapers of the present becomes actual here. In a sense, modernist primitivism was not primitive enough for my post-war figures. As a result, some like Jorn turned to mythology and archaeology, and others like Bataille to anthropology and prehistory. The discovery of Lascaux in 1940 triggered a resurgence in that field. Certainly for Bataille, the prehistoric displaces not only the primitive, but also the ancient as the originary site of art and representation. Although prehistory had interested pre-war modernists like Amédée Aux-Enfants, there are telling differences. For example, in keeping with the modernist emphasis on pure vision, Aux-Enfants saw the handprints on cave walls as direct traces of the first man, whereas Bataille saw them as ambiguous signs of a being conflicted about its own humanness. Then too, in the post-war period in general, the image of the first man was shadowed by the specter of the last man. That is, interest in prehistory was haunted by anxiety about post-history. And sometimes my figures imagine a strange synchrony between an absolute before and a no less absolute other, or after. Implicit in Jorn, Palozzi, and Oldenburg, this is explicit in Bataille, for whom the caves are both the cradle of humanity and its tomb in waiting. If the topos of the primitive shifts with these post-war figures, so too does the image of the animal. The animal is also present in modernist art, of course, especially in expressionism, where it is often another avatar of pure vision. Is there a more mysterious idea for an artist than to imagine how nature is reflected in the eyes of an animal? Franz Marc wondered. How does a horse see the world? How does an eagle, a dog, or a deer? In brutal aesthetics, however, the animal mutates variously into a beast, a god, a monster, or a creature. And in this last guise, it registers not a natural state to reclaim, but a denatured condition to confront. In short, the animal has no stable meaning here. For Bataille, it marks, in its very difference, the emergence of the human order in the caves, whereas for Jorn and Palozzi, it registers a contemporary crisis in that same order. Like the rough beast of Yeats, the creature is a mythical being that slouches on to the historical stage precisely at a moment when what counts as law and sovereignty becomes murky. There's another shift in avatars to mention. A key persona in pre-war avant-gardes is the artist as engineer, who is presented often in utopian guise, as in constructivism, and sometimes in a debilitated state, as in Dada. In both cases, however, such constructors build from the ground up, as Benjamin says, with figures designed on the drawing board. This is less the way with my post-war artists, who displace the engineer as a central persona with the bricoleur. In his influential definition of 1962, Lévi-Strauss opposed the two types directly. Whereas the engineer questions the universe with abstract logic, the bricoleur makes do with whatever is at hand, with a heterogeneous collection of oddments left over from human endeavors. This account derives from the very milieu that concerns us. Lévi-Strauss associated the bricoleur explicitly with art brut, about which he corresponded with Dubuffet. My artists propose other related avatars as well. Dubuffet speaks of his artistic role as a sorcerer and an alchemist, and Oldenburg of his as a magician and a clown. Whatever the individual twists, the artist as bricoleur puts into focus a key paradox, that these artists begin again with the already given, with found work, as in the art brut collected by Dubuffet, appropriated images, as in the flea market canvases painted over by Jorn, industrial fragments, as recast by Palozzi, and urban detritus, as remade by Oldenburg. In this respect, the practice of bricolage differs from the use of the ready-made. Again, my group is distinct from the Duchampian New Avant-Garde. At the same time, bricolage is not simply a repeat of collage either. Certainly, the dialectics of shock and Dada and surrealism are not at work in the same ways. How could one outshock the photos of Auschwitz or Hiroshima, and why would anyone attempt to do so in any case? Finally, bricolage also differs from constructed sculpture. Again, my positive barbarians are more interested in destruction as both a means and an end. Even so, brutal aesthetics is not nihilistic. As Oldenburg suggests, to annihilate is only the first step. To illuminate, to connect, to transform, to reanimate is the important thing. In fact, my positive barbarian might be labeled Homo connectus, and his password might be given as metamorphosis. However, my figures do not view such transformation as sublimation. On the contrary, the drive to desublimate, to undo proper forms, and to loosen libidinal energies is very strong in this group. Again, most turn figuration into a brutal disfiguration and see representation as a violent alteration. How then are we to square this disruptive bricolage with the commitment to painting on the part of Dubuffet and Jorn, and to sculpture on the part of Palozzi and Oldenburg? Most of my artists operate within these traditional categories, to be sure, but they also work against them. At the very least, they transform them substantially. For example, Dubuffet not only operated on the horizontal, but also worked the ground into his canvases. He takes painting down, literally humiliates it. Humus means ground. And a similar thing can be said of Jorn with his deformed figures and ugly colors, or of Polozzi and Oldenburg with their different debasements of sculpture. All bring in materials, marks, and models, such as asphalt, graffiti, and the urban wall, respectively, that were mostly foreign to art heretofore. And they do so not only for the sake of disruption, but in the hope of an alternative address, even another audience, beyond the given channels of traditional painting and sculpture. Even though most are suspicious of mass culture, they do not hesitate to appeal to the common man, as with Dubuffet, the banalities of kitsch, as with Jorn, or the pop iconography then in emergence, as with Polozzi and Oldenburg. My group does not take a Mandarin position on these matters. Rather, they see them as post-war conditions to address and to detourn. A third question. Given the equivocal relation of post-positive barbarism to the human figure, what is its view of humanism at large? For my group, this tradition arrived with a few counts against it. First were its own attacks on modernism, such as the charge of the dehumanization of art by Ettore Cassatt and others, as well as the call for a return to order by Jean Cocteau and others, both from the interwar period, but both still fresh enough. More importantly, humanism had proved to be helpless before fascism and Nazism, which had also perverted the classical tradition. This was the civilization turned barbaric that had to be survived in the first instance. For these reasons, Dubuffet, Bataille, and Jorn all railed against humanism. Dubuffet went so far as to call for a complete liquidation of its ways of thinking. Certainly all my figures rejected classical norms of beauty. For his part, Bataille extolled the paradoxical beauty of the prehistoric Venuses, and Jorn elevated the crude productions of the Vandal North over the canonical masterpieces of the classical South, while the others sided with vulgar expressions like graffiti. Most were also happy to be deemed bad painters or sculptors, which is to say they rejected the normativity of the good as well as the beautiful. Those who try to combat the production of shoddy pictures are enemies of the best art today, Jorn wrote in one anti-hierarchical challenge typical of the group. Yet to question an inhuman humanism, as Jorn called it, is not necessarily to be anti-humanist. After all, the critique of humanism is still made in the name of the human, which it hopes to redeem. Moreover, the figures that recur in this art, such as the creaturely and the monstrous, are also articulated in relation to the human, which is thereby kept front and center. Already in antiquity, homo barbarus was structural to the definition of homo humanus, and so it was again in the Renaissance. By and large, then, my artists are equivocal about humanism, as Oldenburg is when he declares, "I am a humanist bastard." Does he mean that he is a bastard simply because he is a humanist, or because the degradation of humanism degrades him too? Either way, Oldenburg aims to make hostile objects human, to de-reify the world, to reanimate life, an ambition shared by the others. This is not a reversal of humanism so much as a détournement, as defined by Jorn. Détournement is a game born of a capacity for devalorization. Only he who is able to devalorize can create new values. A fourth question, a large one. What conceptions of history and philosophy can be drawn from brutal aesthetics? In dire moments, some of my figures envision history thrown in reverse, with progress become regression, somewhat in line with the grim argument of Adorno and Horkheimer in the Dialectic of Enlightenment of 1944. While others project a post-historical condition with the modernist proposal of the new man now farcical, and the Hegelian notion of the end of man no longer speculative. At other times, my figures simply feel stuck, as if history had stalled and dialectics were suspended. To be sure, this stuckness prompts some of my figures to force quasi-dialectical ways of working. For example, stymied by the bipolar stagnation of the Cold War, Jorn develops his prolix notion of trialectics, while Polozzi proposes his obscure theory of opposites, and Oldenburg his volatile practice of contraries, whereby his deathly street is followed by his erotic store. But these count as symptoms of the problem rather than solutions to it. Certainly my figures remain interested in negation, or at least in negativity. In a post-war letter to the philosopher Alexander Kojève, who had presented the end of man thesis before the war, Bataille describes his unemployed negativity. And Dubuffet and Bataille in particular seize on negative remainders, such as the brute and the base, that appear to resist any cultural assimilation. Often, however, the sense of stuckness renders my figures equivocal by default, and sometimes it leads them to force artistic transformations in very tendentious ways. A fifth question, also large. What are the politics of brutal aesthetics? Liberal democracy was in crisis well before World War II, and some of my figures are equivocal on this subject too. To borrow the well-known phrase of the historian Zev Sternhell, they are neither left nor right. The consequences of this equivocation are still debated, with Dubuffet and Bataille the most controversial cases. The others tended toward Marxist positions, Jorn most emphatically. But for many artists and writers in this generation, the link between modernism and socialism, as articulated by T.J. Clarke, was broken. Perhaps it was never so secure in the first place. In any case, brutal aesthetics arises from a different conjuncture, one marked, in some quarters, by a fatigue with politics, especially after all the accusations of collaboration and amidst all the calls for commitment. As advocated by the young Roland Barthes, who resisted the Sartrean demand for political engagement, writing Degree Zero was in part a search for a literature blanched of ideology. And much the same can also be said of Art Degree Zero of the period. For this generation, Denis Ollier has argued, literature was an art of despiteness. And some of my artists exhibit a similar blank refusal. However pallid it might appear, this can count as a politics of its own. Unemployed negativity has its own force. Then again, several of my figures do broach a fundamental question in political theory. I did not expect the issue of sovereignty to be so persistent, yet there it is, explicit in Bataille, but active in most others as well. Perhaps this should not have surprised me. After all, they operate not only in the ruins of a world war, but also in the vice between Soviet totalitarianism to the east and American triumphalism to the west. This overdetermined situation, an old liberal order destroyed by Nazi and fascist regimes, these regimes overcome but at immense cost, a treacherous Cold War locked in place, these conditions had to prompt questions about the nature of political authority, which is to say, a deepened uncertainty about the ground of lawful rule, as well as a concomitant interest in figures that might count as outsiders or outlaws to it. The figure of the sovereign calls up as its opposite number, the beast. And as we will see, the creaturely does sometimes appear as a sign of crisis in the social order. But then, I was on the lookout for such symptoms. These lectures are part of a larger project of mine to rethink the 20th century avant-garde, at times of political emergency. A final note on politics. Most of my artists posit a ground that is largely individualistic, art as an arc of one. And this limits the political ramifications of each project. At the same time, some of my figures do project an idea of collectivity, a sketchy one, non-utopian, but still. Certainly, they explore what might count as a vernacular culture after the Nazi and fascist perversion of the people, or as a common culture in the face of a mass media on the rise. Here, the phrase positive barbarism requires a little more attention. When Benjamin presented it, he employed a particular term, barbarentum, which is not the usual word for the opposite of civilization, which is barbari. The choice is telling. Although by the 19th century, barbarentum signified a primitive state of formation, even earlier, it indicated the distribution of foreigners in a given region. Barbarentum might thus be translated as barbarianhood, a collective that is in part real and in part imagined. If Benjamin saw his modernist barbarentum as the proletarian alternative to a moribund bourgeois culture, it is not clear how my figures viewed their versions, not quite in default of proletarian culture, but hardly identical with it. For Bataille, all society was in need of barbarization, that is, in need of a fundamental recovery of sacred experience. Dubuffet focused his appeal on the common man, whom he projected as an outsider. In this respect, his collective partook less of the proletariat proper than of the lumpen proletariat. The refuse of all classes that, according to Marx, is more likely to be a bribe tool of reactionary intrigue than an integral part of socialist change. For his part, Jorn pursued actual forms of collaborative practice, such as murals, ceramics, and publications, which he regarded as micro models of a communal life to come. In pre-capitalist modes, he hoped to find post-capitalist possibilities. At the same time, he took the banalities of popular culture, such as flea market paintings, as a crucial resource. Palozzi and Oldenburg also developed a double strategy. For Palozzi, this entailed a search for archetypes that were collective in nature, on the one hand, and for iconic images that might compete with Hollywood and Hammer films, on the other. For Oldenburg, it meant an attempt to reground art in the shared experience of everyday life, on the one hand, and to match the American deities of consumer culture, on the other. In each case, the projected collectivities were largely impossible, and the artistic projects almost desperate. But then I come back to the notion of the creaturely as a sign of crisis. And weirdly, I find a modicum of hope there. Recall again the pre-war fascination with the primitive, the child, and the insane. For the most part, scholars like me have charted this modernist exploration in terms of the unconscious and the other. That is, in terms of psychoanalysis and anthropology. This approach is not wrong as far as it goes, but to the extent that such primitivism appealed to an absolute alterity, it assumed a centrality, a stability in Western subjectivity and society. The appearance of the creaturely in my figures points in another direction, not to an outside or a before to culture, which is more or less fictive, but to cracks within the symbolic order, fissures in the space of meaning created by exposure to a dramatic dimension of political power, which are quite real. Some of my artists attempt to force these cracks into new openings, new possibilities for artistic practice and social relations alike. Or so I will argue in the weeks ahead, and I hope you will stick around. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art production.